The McIlvaney Weekly Commentary, covering monetary, economic, and geopolitical news events. Now here are Kevin Orrick and David McIlvaney.
Welcome to the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary. I'm Kevin Orrick along with David McIlvaney. David, we have democracy. We have republic. We have fascist socialism. We have a lot of different types of governments. But there's been a new term coined in Zero Hedge, and I think it probably is the most appropriate for where we are right now.
It's ineptocracy. Ineptocracy is a system of government where the least capable to lead are elected by the least capable of producing, and where the members of society least likely to sustain themselves or succeed are rewarded with the goods and services paid for by the confiscated wealth of a diminishing number of producers. That's ineptocracy.
Ineptocracy. Well, yeah.
No, I found this in a thread on one of my favorite blogs, and it was very interesting. We're looking at one statistic which supports this notion of ineptocracy. The U.S. borrows between 43 and 52 cents of every dollar it spends. Now, the variance has to do with the outlays and receipts, tax revenues, changing from month to month. So remember the comments from David Walker.
Right, and he didn't stick around. David Walker was there for 10 years at the GAO, but he said, you know what, you guys are not listening to me. We're not going to be able to pay our bills. I'm going to go tell America since you won't change anything.
Former Comptroller General, head of the GAO, 98 to 08. Double-digit GDP growth is what he said is required. Double-digit GDP growth uninterrupted for 50 years, that would get us back to being in front of our debt obligations. And again,
when was that? When has that happened in our lifetimes, Dave?
It hasn't. I mean, that's the point. He's saying there is a way back to normalcy, but it's not very feasible.
And we haven't had a single year of double-digit growth.
No,
not since we were born.
No, and so it does come back to some combination of tax increases and spending cuts. It comes back to fiscal responsibility. It comes back to a democracy that is of the people, by the people, for the people, not an ineptocracy. And that's exactly what we're dealing with. So now being in the new year, we have the farcical fiscal cliff behind us. We have the debt ceiling below us.
Right.
We've already passed it. And the question of national solvency is on the table. The only thing that compounds foreign creditor stresses at this point would be further demonstration of the previously mentioned ineptocracy.
Well, and you know, you're talking about ceilings, debt ceilings, what have you, but you know, this is a multi-story building ineptocracy that we live in. So a debt ceiling is nobody, you know, your debt ceiling may be somebody else's floor, maybe somebody else's ceiling, maybe somebody else's floor, maybe somebody else's ceiling. You know, do people really take any of these talks seriously anymore, whether it's fiscal cliff or debt ceilings? I mean, they just raise them.
Well, and that's been the classic case up to this point. Now, we will see major wrangling over the fiscal cliff, and that is a question. The question of, will rating agencies step in and say, given this political ineptitude, what will the outcome be? Will we see a downgrade? Will we see two downgrades? Will we see foreign creditors begin to, as they already have, if you're looking at the TIC flows, exit treasury positions and begin to move to other asset classes as a preference?
Well,
we're already seeing that here at the beginning of 2013.
That would cause another financial crisis, though, Dave. I mean, we've had a fiscal crisis. We're in a fiscal crisis, but that would cause a financial crisis like we experienced in 2008 or worse, because interest rates would have to
move. And I think it's worth sort of going back and looking at 2008 and comparing it to what we have now in the making, because 2008 was sort of an accident. Somebody dropped a hand grenade, the pin fell out, it blew up, there was bodies all over, and we say, how did this happen? And somebody says, well, gosh, you shouldn't be walking around with hand grenades. So somebody did see it coming. It wasn't completely a quote-unquote black swan, but it was messy, it was ugly, and it didn't have to happen. Now, this scenario is slightly different in the sense that we have a fiscal crisis. crisis. And following almost every fiscal crisis is a financial crisis. Greece is a real-time study of this. Argentina illustrates changes in the banking system and in monetary policy, you know, when you're moving through the stages of fiscal and then ultimately financial crisis. And, you know, there is a similarity between Argentina and Greece and some of these southern European countries. And recall, Argentina, they're not done with their crisis. It's 11 years on. And, you know, of course, they had their bank accounts were restricted. All this came from disconnecting from a dollar peg.
But yeah, they started with the dollar peg and then they disconnected and it created the crisis that they have continued in.
Exactly. And what it led to was printing beginning in earnest once they left the dollar peg because they didn't like the tough talk of austerity.
Right.
They kept paying their obligations, but they were paying their obligations with newly printed scrip. Of course, it didn't buy what it once did.
Sure.
But don't let that confuse the issue. Today, Southern Europe is going down that Argentine path and putting the burden of correction on creditors, with austerity being more or less discussed than implemented.
Yeah, Dave, you know, I remember as a kid just hearing the little boy who cried wolf, and it got to be where, you know, no one listened to him because he cried wolf all the time. Well, austerity is the new wolf. They talk about it all the time to the point where it has absolutely no impact or no follow through.
Well, in Southern Europe, you have the same currency straitjacket which Argentina had with the U.S. dollar peg. With those ties to the euro, we could see a second shoe drop in Spain, in Italy, in Portugal, in Greece, particularly in the wake of the last month's Argentine cases being heard in New York, which recently determined in favor of U.S. creditors. They reestablished a claim on Argentine assets, and they established that claim all over the world. So you have actually a U.S. hedge fund which just laid claim to a ship owned by Argentina in North Africa.
So it was collateralized whether Argentina knew it or not.
Well, and this is very disconcerting for those in Europe because, you know, we've just gone through a cycle of quote-unquote voluntary haircuts.
Right.
And here you have this negotiated peace with creditors in Argentina, and it being undone. If those voluntary haircuts are reversible, you can undo any restabilization which you've had in the Eurozone in the latter part of 2012. So not to mention the more mundane issue of revenues have actually been declining more than predicted in the context of Southern Europe. And again, financial crisis, you know, takes center stage and businesses and individuals basically go into survival mode.
Right.
They don't quickly reemerge. And when they're in survival mode, you have two things that happen. One, you have greater tax evasion. You also have less taxes to pay as businesses just slow down in terms of a volume of trade.
So what we should expect is not just one F. You know, I think of going back to school. You know, you get an F, that's a bad deal. But what you're saying is these Fs come in twos, financial and fiscal, or fiscal and financial.
All that to say, the two Fs, fiscal and financial, go together like a 1-2 punch.
Mm-hmm.
And if 2012 to 2013 is the U.S. entree into the fiscal crisis limelight, you might expect another round of financial crisis around the corner.
Now, so you're talking 2014, 15, 16, yeah, something
how
in
soon,
that neighborhood.
You know, what we can do is watch the dollar and watch treasury yields. As go treasuries, so goes the entire fixed income complex. Across credit qualities, across maturities, moving the benchmarks is either helpful, as it has been over the last 2 to 3 years with artificially low rates set by the Fed, or harmful. Now, is that 2014, 15, or 16? I think there's some external variables which will likely determine the time frame, but foreign purchases of treasuries may be telling us all we need to know right now.
Well, you know, one of the things about financial crisis and fiscal crisis, Dave, is if it plays itself out completely, you actually come back in strong. You know, a lot of these problems that we had in 2008 were caused by just having junk loans that most people knew could not be repaid back, like mortgages, what have you. Now, what we have is a reliquification of the banking system under Basel III. You know, Basel III right now is supposedly going to strengthen the banking system, but it seems like it's just a replay of the past.
Yeah, so again, that comparison between 2008 and the present, 2008, you had over-leveraged financial institutions, and all of a sudden, there was a revaluation of the assets on their balance sheet, and they realized that they were undercapitalized. And so the effort since then by the folks in Basel, Bank of International Settlements, has been to create liquidity requirements, a liquidity buffer, and that is what you're talking about, Basel III.
The that sounds good. I mean, to a person who says, well, what's wrong with liquidity in the banking system?
On this last week, the Basel III liquidity rules fixed the banking system, which, I mean, again, for anyone clued in, really means that time is the primary commodity which banks wanted, and that's exactly what they got. Mm. But nevertheless, you have these long-awaited issues which were determined this week for what is the first ever global baseline for banks concerning their liquid assets and thus a capital cushion for those banks and the entire banking system. And therefore, safety and stability should those banks ever come under stress. That was what Basel III was all about.
Right. But I guess the question, Dave, is who's really the winner? I mean, Basel III, they're coming in and putting this baseline in on banks, but it sounds to me like it's just to create more and more leverage in the future. And like you said, buy time rather than them having to pay the bad debt off that they already have built up.
The technocrats would argue that ultimately it's for the public's good that the financial sector is strong. And there is an argument there I would agree with. But to some degree, Basel this time seems to have clearly defined decorum for all the foxes. Mm-hmm. And I mean, again, in terms of henhouse conduct and what is considered sort of the safe and acceptable plucking, you had two things. One, you had a change in the time frame. And again, this is sort of the phase-in for liquid assets. They have a four-year phase-in. What is called the LCR, or liquid coverage ratio, measures how much liquid assets the bank needs to have in place to absorb a shock, and furthermore, what assets can be used as quote-unquote liquid assets. So they need to be at 60% of the goal in 4 years, and then they have a full 6 years, so until 2019, to add 10% per year thereafter, again, until that 2019 period, to be at 100% of what they want as a liquid coverage ratio.
Well, let's define what liquid assets are. I mean, you and I, when we're thinking safe liquid assets, we're thinking U.S. Treasuries, cash, gold, what have you. What is included in the safe liquid asset category?
Up to this point, banks were assuming the same thing, Kevin, and this is where they were sort of loading the boat with quality assets. Now, all of a sudden, they've been given a new lease on life, so to say. The second change was to the acceptable liquid assets. And this one is curious. You've got BBB- paper. You've got corporate paper. You've got some equities. You've got healthy residential mortgages or mortgage-backed securities. All of these make the new list of acceptably liquid assets that can serve as a capital cushion.
And when you're saying healthy residential mortgages, you're talking in parentheses, healthy. Residential mortgages.
And this is
right.
This is just it. You've already taken a multi-step down. It was going to be AA paper, some corporate paper accepted. I don't think equities were really on the table. And then, of course, you've got the residential mortgage-backed securities. They're liquid until they're not. I think this is what people learned in 2008. The entire stock of assets in question, outside of treasuries and gold, or just straight cash, which is boring and bankers don't earn anything on it. That's why they don't like it. These boring assets are what they need.
Right.
And yet Basel told them, listen, we understand that's going to be a tough target to reach if we limit you to just what you need.
Well, and I think it's worth pointing out, Dave, had they not started counting some of these assets like BBB bonds and residential real estate notes, what would they have to do?
Well, they would have had to raise $2.4 trillion in new capital at a minimum. That's your top 200 banks. And of course, Basel III is meant to apply to the whole banking universe. Mm-hmm. What is the bottom line? What is the bottom line with Basel III and this week's announcement? Leverage will re-enter the financial system. The banksters will be back operating on the streets in the light of day with the blessing of the rest of the banking community. That's the sick irony here, is that it is a banking regulator who's saying it's okay for banks to do this. You have structural reforms in the financial system, which are tough, very tough to pencil out, even tougher to implement. And that is not what we saw.
Right.
This leaves banks, and of course, this is the healthy side, this leaves banks with the flexibility to organize aggressive balance sheets and increase profitability. Yes, this is good for banks in terms of their rate of return in the next 6 to 12 months, but they've avoided the strictures of scarce quality assets. The bottom line, again, risk remains, That's the bottom line.
Well, and I think what we found with the banking system as a whole, worldwide and here in this nation, is there's moral hazard. I mean, it's moral hazard because these guys can go do these things and not really need to get paid back because there's always a bailout coming from the taxpayer.
Well, and in the banking community, when they were told that they would have to raise capital and only use the highest quality paper as a cushion, as a liquid cushion, they basically said, oh, we can't do that. In the banking community, the regulators of the banking community said, you're right, you don't have to do that. I mean, it's the enforcer, quote unquote, basically said, I know. We had really high expectations. We were just kind of joking about that. You know, really cleaning up your balance sheet and introducing structural reform into the banking community. Maybe we were a little aggressive. Maybe we were just acting out of panic given our experience from 2008 and 2009. But again, everyone is assuming growth from here forward.
Well, you know, speaking of growth, we had listened to banter about the cliff deal, the fiscal cliff that was coming, and it really, after the election, it really came front and center. Now, we have a deal, whatever the deal is, and it really doesn't solve the problem, but I think it's important that our listeners understand some of the basics of this cliff deal that came about in Washington.
Well, and to save some time, there was sort of a brief listing of the main points on our wealth management website. If you look at our Friday comment, which we put up every Friday for our clients, we did include some of the highlights of the changes in terms of taxes, not all of them bad, and some of the limitations as well. But on the surface, it's set to reduce the deficit by raising $620 billion in revenues.
Right.
In contrast to that, you have the Congressional Budget Office, which predicts a drain on revenues, from the economy by $3.63 trillion over 10 years.
So six times what the revenues supposedly are going to be, that's what the drain is going to be.
And then throw in an extra $333 billion in spending over the same period, and you're talking about roughly a $4 trillion reversal to the bad,
right,
even though what's being publicized is we're all good here. Now, I mean, again, this is not some third-party group who says, you know, we want radical reforms, we want extreme austerity measures. This is the Congressional Budget Office, and they're saying, hey, we're not quite in agreement with that $620 billion in increased revenues and that being sort of a straight boost to our fiscal position. This is the issue. In D.C., it's the case of the last liar in wins.
Well, and it's not just that. I always get worried when D.C. says they're going to solve a problem, because usually what they do is they just increase the problem. I mean, you've got crony capitalism right now that was built into that system, and there are people who walked away smiling, going, wow, we even got more.
Yeah, I have a hard time controlling my blood pressure on this one. The Cliff deal included $76 billion in special interest tax credits. If you're wondering how GE and others, big businesses, multinational corporations, don't have to pay taxes, and you think, well, that's absurd. Of course they have to pay taxes. Everybody pays taxes. No, that's not true. You find a former senator, you find a rainmaker to lobby on your behalf and allow your profits to be held in offshore accounts, avoiding the U.S. tax man. Now, remember, GE has a very incestuous relationship with government.
Well, can I just interrupt here? Because GE was originally brought about by Thomas Edison, okay, and it was placed on the Dow Jones Industrial Average, the very first one, when there were 12 stocks back in 1896. There is only one company still on the Dow that is represented by that original list of stocks, and that's GE. So I'm guessing if you want to survive as a company, you better have lobbyists in Washington.
Well, I've always thought of General Electric as a company that represents the market. It's essentially a mutual fund in one company.
Right.
They're in everything, whether it's wind energy or turbines or what don't they make? What are they not involved with, including finance? But the reality is they do represent the market today, but not because of their broad representation of business interests. They represent the market today because they represent the trend in the market, which is towards fascism, which is towards corporatism, which is towards government sponsorship. And the fact that they rarely pay taxes shouldn't surprise us. That's what you get when you cozy up.
Now, well, now, David, you run a company. Do you pay taxes?
50% plus. The tax burden, if you're not a corporatist giant with hundreds of CPAs and paid lobbyists negotiating a different treatment for you, is a real burden.
Yeah. So, David, just like in Animal Farm, Orwell talks about how all pigs are equal, but there are some pigs that are more equal than others.
Now, I may be overstepping my bounds here, but I look at Trent Lott's role as a former Republican senator, lobbyist, who put this deal together along with another Democratic senator, retired, but now lobbyist. It would do us as a country some benefit if he would practice the discipline of a samurai and disembowel himself. I mean, I'm serious. This is not fascism. If it's not fascism at its finest, I don't know what it is. Maybe it's less complex. Maybe it's just corruption without the whitewash. But, you know, so, okay, I take that back. Harry Caray is not as imperative as, if you've named your son or dog Trent within the last 20 years, could you change the name? Could you change the name? The man is a disgrace. There are Democrats who are equally disgraceful as Washington whores, but they never claimed a higher level of integrity. They never claimed to have fiscal virtue. And so to some degree, they're less culpable. In all seriousness, Kevin, at a minimum, I am sending a copy of Chesterton's book, this G.K. Chesterton's book, What's Wrong with the World? And I'm sending it to Trent Lott's office. That's the title of the book, What's Wrong with the World? The opening lines of the book, I am yours truly, G.K. Chesterton. Now, obviously, he writes an entire book, but that's how he opens it. And I think it would do Trent some good to reflect on this for his benefit and ours. What's wrong with the world? Trent, you are. Yours truly, David McIlvaney.
Well, and I'll tell you, David, I know your blood pressure is boiling right now, but one of the things that we've talked about over and over, we have a lot of retired clients that had saved all of their life to live off of a reasonable amount of interest on their money. That, of course, has been taken away by the Federal Reserve and by the policies of trying to, you know, hold up, like we talked about, the banks or what have you. Interest rates are zero virtually on anything safe right now. But what that's done is it's forced those people who would normally not be in a position to take a risk into bonds that we would have called junk just a couple of years ago. David, granted, they've renamed it. It's no longer politically correct to call them junk bonds, but that's exactly what they are because at some point they'll probably fail.
For 2012, it's worthy of note that one of the best performing asset classes outside of Greek bonds, its own irony, I realize, but outside of Greek bonds, junk bonds,
right,
performed 15% for 2012, outperforming the equity markets. And, you know, there was $425 billion worth of junk bonds sold worldwide last year. For 2013, in the U.S. alone, not worldwide, they're expecting to sell another $300 billion, according to Barclays. Again, this is in the junk bond space.
Yeah, but David, back in the old days, a junk bond would yield 10, 12, 14% because the risk of default was so high. With the popularity of junk bonds right now, they're not having to pay hardly anything.
Which makes last week's record low yields on junk bonds amazing, 5.89%.
That's what you could get on U.S. Treasuries, David, in the last decade.
I know. The opposite side of the equation is that you've got record high prices in the junk bond space, which is giving you your 15% return. Junk bonds generally trade at a discount, implying that there is credit risk well above normal corporate issues.
Right.
That's just the way they normally trade. Most today, though, are trading at premiums. So effectively, as you were suggesting, effectively the Fed, having set the Fed funds rate at nothing, has collapsed yields across the fixed income universe, erasing any real content, any real substantive meaning or implied data that you can draw from yields. Credit market risk is not being well accounted for.
Well, David, the investors were talking about seeking yields. Most of these people should not be taking these risks and probably even know they are taking a risk, but they're in a corner right now. They have to pay their bills or dip into their principal.
And this is the problem. They've decided to eschew the volatility in the equity market and they're choosing the lesser of two evils. On the one hand, you can either eat into principal, as you suggest, in the absence of a return on assets, and thus they're searching for yield. Unknowingly, they're taking on liquidity risk, and they're compromising sort of the safety profile of their portfolios.
Yeah, so basically, David, what you're saying is a person has two choices with their money, especially when they have to have an income. They're either going to dip into principal, or they're going to chase a yield. The only problem, Dave, is the danger of getting that yield has a bite back.
Unknowingly, they're taking on liquidity risk, and they're compromising the safety of their portfolio in that search for yield. Chasing yield is a little bit like hunting a lion with a toothpick. It's absolute guaranteed entertainment. You have to ask the question, can the audience stomach it? When you move out of equities, what we've seen over the last 12 months is a mass move, actually 18 months, 24 months, out of equities, particularly equity mutual funds, into junk bonds.
Mm-hmm.
You mentioned this earlier. They've renamed them high yield. And it's clearly moving from the frying pan into the fire. And our recommendation is don't be the last one out of the fire.
Right. Right.
You know, the veterans to the bond market know that you don't get to sit back and clip a large coupon when you buy junk bonds. You don't just buy it. It's yielding a fat, but in this case, 6%, 7%, 8% yield if you were buying it a year ago, and just collect that interest willy-nilly. No, in fact, there's major swings. The volatility in the junk bond space is fairly radical. It's a trader's gig, and the price swings are perpetual. It is either the best of times or the worst of times. And we've just put in record high prices, record low yields. You be my guest. Where do we go from here?
Sure. I doubt that the yields are going to go much lower than they are now, which means the price or the value of those bonds is probably topping out at this point.
So brush up on your Edgar Allan Poe. The pendulum will swing back.
The pendulum does swing back. Now, okay, not all corporate paper is junk, however. There are good corporate bonds, and there's corporate paper coming due in large amounts right now that it's being restructured.
And this is very healthy. If you're looking at corporate America and the actions that they're taking, refinancing paper, not just what's coming due, but actually calling some of their existing bonds at higher rates, it's pretty impressive. Last year, it was over $620, I think close to $640 billion for 2012, of paper that came due and got refinanced. $449 billion is due in 2013. $449 billion for this year. Then in 2014, the maturity schedule bumps up to $484 billion with a slightly larger year for 2015, $495 billion. Now, these are funding requirements or the, you know, money that has to be rolled over, and we do need a healthy financial system in which to roll paper. You lose your ability to roll paper. That rollover risk exists if there's constraints in the financial markets and concerns about credit quality. So if things are getting better from here, then clearly 2013, 2014, and 2015 will not be an issue for corporations. But with close to $500 billion in refinancing needs each year for the next three, we really need the financial system to be clipping along at a healthy pace.
So, David, unlike our government, who's doing it exactly opposite, you've got corporations right now taking advantage of the low rates. They're calling their higher-paying bonds, and they're lengthening maturities, they're calling bonds, they're reissuing at a lower rate, which is just advantageous for the corporation. If our government would actually take a lesson that way, we could be cleaning things up right now.
Well, sure. Refinancing debt at lower rates is a boost to corporate America. That is going to be of long-term benefit in terms of stability, survivability. What about the U.S.? Are we reducing our interest payments? Well, to some degree we are, but we're not taking advantage of those long-dated maturities.
Right.
The U.S. should be taking advantage of low rates and financing as much of it as they can in 20- and 30-year paper, and it's not happening, which increases over the same time frame, 2013, 2014, 2015, increases rollover risk specifically in the Treasury market, which is, again, something we'll have to explore in years to come.
Well, David, you know, part of the news of this week is that the Federal Reserve all of a sudden is finding religion. They're starting to say, you know what, maybe we're not going to do the QE as long as we thought we were going to do. Is that a reality?
We seriously doubt this. I mean, consider the ramifications to a reduction of asset purchases. If the Fed quits its current program, the impact is going to be felt across every asset class. Now, we'll give you a list in terms of an order of severity. Treasuries, particularly 10-year paper and higher beyond that. Mortgage-backed securities. Mortgage rates will rise, even as some have been suggesting in nascent housing and recovery. If you begin to see a rise in the cost of capital,
that'll be over.
Again, you can squash something that was just getting going. Equities, you know, again, like a crack addict in need of another hit, equities would give up a 10%, 15% at a minimum in short order if the Fed were to do more than just talk about this issue. If they were to pull back and not be buying assets, not re-liquefying the financial system through asset purchases, major ramifications there.
Well, if the Fed tightened up or slowed down on QE, wouldn't that put pressure on gold and silver, though, on the downside?
Short-term pressure would remain, but remember that the metal story over the last 10 years was not primarily a Fed activity story, but a Fed non-activity story. Mm-hmm. You know, by taking rates to zero and leaving them there, you've driven investors out of a negative yielding asset, whether that's, you know, stocks, bonds, what have you, into a holding pattern, and the safest holding pattern is one where you don't have to choose a denomination. In other words, you don't have to choose yen, you don't have to choose euros, you don't have to choose dollars. And that has been the pattern where discouraged investors the world over in a negative to low real rate environment have been shifting their emphasis to gold. reducing asset purchases would have little effect on the metals. Now, also consider the timing. Consider the timing of their announcement. Just as the consumer is seeing a diminishment of available resources via higher payroll taxes and will likely be recalibrating their consumption, the Fed's going to find religion under these circumstances? No. This is ridiculous. You need to watch what the Fed does more than what they say they're going to do. They talked tough about buying everything on the planet last year, and they expanded their balance sheet virtually nothing. We started the year at around $3 trillion. We ended the year at around $3 trillion. The Fed was largely inactive in terms of all the measures they put in place. They were mostly balance sheet neutral. Now, all of a sudden, they're talking tough and want to tell you that inflation is not going to be an issue. We're not going to see balance sheet expansion. And yet that's exactly what's happening even as we speak, even if on a small scale. We think that 2013 is defined by an increase in Fed balance sheet, $500 billion, $1 trillion. We should be coming close to $4 trillion in terms of the Fed total balance sheet. And of course, that puts their leverage at well over 60 to 1.
Well, and David, we've often talked about the dual mandate for the Federal Reserve, which in this way, they're absolutely speaking out of both sides of their mouth, because they're talking about tightening up, yet they've changed the mandate from price stability and keeping employment high to now employment has reversed places. Employment is their number one priority. Price stability is second. That came out early in December.
Well, and this is even more important than whatever they happen to be talking about today. You know, we had the election hullabaloo. We had the fiscal cliff cacophony at year end. And I think a lot of people missed what was announced in early December. December 12th, the Fed shifted, and it's a remarkable one. The mandate swap, if you want to call it that, is significant because they took what was their primary mandate, price stability,
right,
and swapped that out for employment. Now, they haven't always had a dual mandate. They used to have just price stability.
But since the 70s, they've had a dual mandate.
And then they brought in employment. The significant upset is that price stability now takes a back seat to the employment concerns, and the mandate swap here is what Mohamed Alarian at PIMCO has called the reverse Volcker moment. You remember Volcker came in at the latter stage of the Carter administration, 1979, and introduced monetary policy reforms to break the back of inflation. Again, the real important thing here, and I think while Alarian is very concerned, is that this is in fact a radical shift.
Right. David, I think it's important to also point out that price stability really is the fight against inflation. In other words, price stability is to say we're worried about inflation, we're not going to let it run rampant. When they say that employment now is a higher priority than price stability, what that really is saying is inflation is coming.
Well, and you could argue that that's actually a failed mandate, you know, that the price stability, which they were charged with, they failed at, and they've seen a 95 to 96% decline in the value of the dollar in the last 100 years. This is their 100-year anniversary. We can all celebrate the existence of the Fed, celebrate their great successes and a few of their failures. Now, the reality is you can do that. You can have a rate of inflation and slowly degrade the value of your currency as long as your economy is growing in lockstep and incomes, critically, are growing at the same time.
Right.
When your income component goes stagnant and your inflation component continues to rise, that's where you end up in a major, major quagmire that happens to be where we're at. So again, going back to Volcker, we think the Fed gave up on price stability a long time ago, but not explicitly. And that's what changed in December, is this explicit move from price stability to a very explicit description of what they want. 6.5% on the unemployment number, and we're not going to quit until we get it. So Volcker, in 1979, began the process of breaking the back of inflation. We see the quote-unquote reverse Volcker moment as a sea change for asset classes. You've got Ben Bernanke and company targeting 6.5% unemployment. They've replaced a specific time frame for stimulus with an employment target that may have been, in our opinion, the opening act of an American tragedy.
Well, and David, not just an American tragedy. We seem to export things, and the UK and Japan are recentering around the same priority. So we've talked in the past about how you can't just have inflation in one country. You export inflation, and it actually builds on itself country by country.
And it's not surprising to hear that the Japanese pension system is discussing a doubling of their gold allocation over the next 2 years. in the age of Abe. Now, this is really interesting. You've got a group of people who are managing assets saying, we understand what this looks like. If you're going to stimulate the economy, quote-unquote, if you're going to focus on growth and employment, quote-unquote, then we need to own more gold. That's the Japanese pension system, which has always piled in hand over fist into Japanese bonds. Again, there's a number of changes, sea changes, within a variety of asset classes that need to be noted, and it goes back to that December 12th note from the Fed. Don't neglect it, because it's probably one of the most important things coming out of 2012 to mark our destination and our journey for 2013 and 2014.
So in this case, do as the central bankers do, do as the Japanese do, start buying gold.
That's exactly right.
Well, you've been listening to the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary. I'm Kevin Orrick, along with David McIlvaney. You can find us at McIlvaney.com. That's McIlvaney.com. Or give us a call at 800-525-9556.
This has been the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary. The views expressed should not be considered to be a solicitation or a recommendation for your investment portfolio. You should consult a professional financial advisor to assess your suitability for risk and investment. Join us again next week for a new edition of the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary.